KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
This is going to have a major consequences for the region and beyond.
As Israel and Iran continue to trade strikes and the U.S. moves its B-2 bombers, is diplomacy still on the table? For Saturday, June 21st, it's All Things Considered. I'm Andrew Limbong. We speak with a former member of the Iranian nuclear negotiating team about a way forward. Also, here's one gender divide we don't hear a lot about.
So there really is this fascinating and illuminating history about why women don't get to have pockets in their clothes.
We learn about a designer who pioneered functional clothing for women. And tourism to places as far off as Antarctica is booming, which hasn't been great for the local ecosystem.
We want that Antarctica that we have now to remain as it is.
And summer's officially here, which means ticks and high heat. We'll find out how to prepare for both. First news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump on his social media site says the U.S. completed a successful attack on three nuclear sites in Iran. He says all planes are now outside of Iran airspace and that a full payload of bombs was dropped on the primary site, Fordo. All planes are safely on their way home. He goes on to say, quote, congratulations to our great American warriors. There's not another military in the world that could have done this. Now is the time for peace. The former Soviet Republic of Belarus, a leading opposition figure, is among nearly a dozen political prisoners released from jail. NPR's Charles Maines has more from Moscow.
Sergei Tikhanovsky disappeared into Belarus's prison system back in 2020 as he launched an election campaign to challenge strongman Alexander Lukashenko for the Belarusian presidency. His wife Svetlana Tikhanovskaya ran in his stead, and her supporters argue won the vote before a crackdown by Lukashenko sent her into political exile and thousands of pro-democracy demonstrators to jail. Tikhanovskaya thanked President Trump for orchestrating her husband's release, which came after Lukashenko met with White House envoy Keith Kellogg in the Belarusian capital, Minsk. 13 others were also released as part of the U.S. brokered deal, but that's just a fraction of the political prisoners who remain behind bars in Belarus. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
The L.A. Dodgers say they will give $1 million to help the city's immigrant population. NPR's Alana Wise has more.
The Dodgers had been silent for weeks on the ongoing immigration raids that have rocked Southern California and sparked anti-ICE protests in the area. Though on Thursday, the Dodgers said they turned ICE away when the agency came to the team stadium and asked for access to its parking lots. ICE denied that its agents had been there. The next day, the Dodgers announced their donation plan and said it would take a leading role in standing up for the families affected. President Trump has said he wants to enact the largest mass deportation in history. He has said ICE and other agencies should continue to target Los Angeles and other cities with Democratic leadership. Alana Wise, NPR News.
As a heat wave hit much of the country this weekend, there are ways to reduce energy usage. NPR's Julia Simon has more.
Tip one involves a physics lesson. Heat will always try to escape from a hotter region to a cooler one. This summer, as outdoor heat tries to come inside your cooler home, you can buy weather stripping tape. Use it to seal up cracks around your windows or doors. Tip two, buy shades for the outside of your house. That's because with inside shades, the sunlight coming through the glass also brings in heat. And finally, make your roof reflective. A lot of the sun's heat gets absorbed through the roof. A white or silvery roof can reflect that heat away. Julia Simon, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. In Brazil, at least 8 people are dead after a hot air balloon caught fire and tumbled from the sky in the southern state of Santa Catarina. Authorities say 13 people survived and were taken to the hospital. Santa Catarina's military fire brigade says 21 people were on board the balloon, including the pilot. Local news video shows smoke billowing out of the balloon amid flames as it hurtled toward the ground. There's no word on a cause. Federal officials have released a new population estimate for eastern North Pacific gray whales. It's about 13,000, the lowest number since the 70s. From member station KNKX, Bellamy Palethorpe has more.
Scientists were expecting the whales to rebound after the end of an unusual mortality event in 2023. These gray whales are known for their past resilience. They travel thousands of miles every year on an epic migration from the calving lagoons in Baja to the Alaskan Arctic, where they feed. But climate change has melted the ice there, making it harder for them to find food. Amy Lang is a research biologist with NOAA Fisheries in Seattle. She says some stranded gray whales appear emaciated.
There's been numerous observations of live whales that are migrating that are really thin.
Lack of food also appears to be affecting reproduction. The estimated calf count is 85. The lowest since records began in 1994. For NPR News, I'm Bellamy Palethorpe in Seattle.
Repeating our top story, President Trump in a social media post says the U.S. completed a successful attack on three nuclear sites in Iran. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong in for Scott Detrow. Today, B-2 bombers took off from Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri and appeared to be headed towards Guam. The move comes as President Trump weighs whether the U.S. will join Israel in its bombardment against Iran. For more than a week now, Israel and Iran have traded airstrikes that have killed at least 430 Iranians and 24 Israelis. That's according to each country's government. President Trump says he wants to see if there's any chance at a diplomatic solution before entering the fight himself. But as the region inches closer to an all-out war and tensions escalate, is diplomacy still possible? Syed Hussein Mousavian is a former Iranian diplomat and nuclear negotiator who is currently a visiting research collaborator at Princeton University. He's with us from Frankfurt, Germany. Welcome.
Thank you, Andrew.
So you were on this program less than 3 weeks ago, and at the time, President Trump said he was close to a deal with Iran over their nuclear program, and you were telling us what a possible deal could look like. All right, now things are very different. Is there one thing that sticks out to you about this past week of fighting?
The most important issue is about a reality that there was no immediate and serious threat in order to justify any military strike by Israel or the U.S. The claim that Iran has enough enriched stockpile to build 10 nuclear bombs in 2 weeks is only half of the truth. The other half is that even if Iran decide to build a nuclear bomb, which they never have decided. But even if they decide, it would take them 1 or 2 years to develop the delivery system, such as nuclear warheads. Therefore, President Trump and Congress, they should be very cautious about such a dangerous and false narratives manufactured to drag the U.S. in a devastating war.
Just to get a sense of where tensions are at now, I was just reading a piece in the New York Times that was reporting that Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, is naming possible successors in case he is killed. Now, that would be a major shift. And if that were to happen, what would that mean for Iran?
I really don't know whether this is true or not, but I would not be surprised, because 3 years ago also we read in Iranian news that Ayatollah Khamenei has proposed the assembly of experts to think about 2-3 candidates as successor. Therefore, this is not really something very exceptional and new.
Iran and Israel have lost civilians in these airstrikes. Is diplomacy possible?
It is possible, first of all, if the U.S. would be ready to make a deal based on international rules and regulations. Andrew, we have the only major international convention on nuclear is Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT. Any deal between Iran and the U.S. should respect this convention, this treaty, and should be in the framework of this treaty. This treaty has entitled every member of state to enjoy peaceful nuclear technology. Therefore, the key issue would be whether uranium enrichment is going to remain peaceful or not.
What is your sense of the likelihood of that route being taken?
If President Trump is going to follow the line and the objectives of Prime Minister Netanyahu, there is a big danger that the U.S. will be engaged in trans-regional war, because Prime Minister Netanyahu's objective is not only to destroy Iranian nuclear facilities, but to bring regime change in Iran, to create instability in the country, and to turn Iran, like Syria, Lebanon, and Libya, into a failed state and then break it apart. This is going to have a major consequences for the region and beyond.
Here in the U.S., though, we've been having this debate, you know, about the U.S. providing specialized weapons to go after an underground nuclear plant in Iran, right? But Israel has already struck a number of Iranian nuclear sites and has killed scientists. Do you think lasting harm has been done to Iran's nuclear program?
Israelis, they have done this before. You remember in 2010, there was cyber attack. In 2010, before and after, they killed many Iranian nuclear scientists. What was the outcome? It was really counterproductive. I mean, assassinating or destroying more nuclear facilities or nuclear scientists would make Iran to become more radicalized and to believe more and more that they need nuclear bomb as deterrence.
That's former Iran nuclear negotiator Syed Hossein Mousavian. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Andrew.
And later in the program, what are the hazards of bombing a nuclear plant? We'll learn more about the underground Iranian nuclear facility where America's bunker-busting bombs may be used. It's about to get really, really hot. The first significant heat wave of the season is expected to hit much of the U.S. this weekend. We're talking temperatures well above 90 and even hitting 100 degrees across the East Coast and into the Midwest. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has warned that warmer than normal temperatures are expected throughout the summer, and experts warn that brutal heat that comes on quickly can be very dangerous for vulnerable populations. To talk more about what to watch for, we've called up Patricia Fabian. She's an associate professor of environmental health at Boston University. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Hello, thank you for the invitation.
So millions of Americans are under heat advisories and warnings right now. Can you translate for us? So what does that mean, and what steps should people take to protect themselves?
When the temperatures get really hot, people's capacity to respond to heat isn't always great. And so what it means is we will expect to see more emergency department visits because of heat stress. We'll expect to see probably an increase in deaths. And the reason that we worry about it more right now in the beginning is because people haven't adapted yet to heat in the same way as they do later in the summer. And so we pay attention a lot to kind of that first heat wave.
When you say people haven't adapted, you mean just like physically their bodies haven't adapted, or they just haven't taken the necessary steps?
You know, that's probably a combination. So one is that people haven't prepared. Maybe their air conditioners aren't put into, like, for window air conditioners. Mm-hmm. They haven't thought about hydration and carrying water bottles. So that's part of it. But the other big part of it is really more the physiological response, that as time goes by and we're exposed to hot weather, our body learns how to sweat and cool down. So it's a combination of things, both your body getting used to the heat and knowing what to do, and then kind of that adaptive behavior that we pick up over the summer.
So this heat wave is also bringing a lot of humidity with it. How does the combination of high heat and high humidity affect people's health?
Basically, humidity makes it feel hotter. Physiologically, what's happening is that when it's humid, the way that your body cools off is by evapotranspiration, which means that it's you're sweating, and then as that sweat evaporates from your body, that cools down your body. When you have really high humidity, what happens is that the sweat doesn't evaporate, essentially.
You're located in Boston, and like a lot of the Northeast, extreme heat waves are relatively like a newer phenomenon there. So what are some like longer term ways people can stay cool in environments like that?
That's a great question. So as you said, in Boston, we've been used to thinking about cold and blizzards and snow days and not heat days. Mm-hmm. And I think for that reason also, all of the buildings have been built up over time to retain heat and not to be cool. Long term, I think that there's a lot of things we can do to the built environment. So the houses where we live, the buildings where we work, the spaces where we play. Some of the things are things like ceiling fans and shades that are pretty low cost, simple to do. Even things like exhaust fans in the kitchen to remove heat as you're cooking. Bigger picture, there's a lot of things we can do to actually the building structures. So things like adding insulation or participating in weatherization programs. Things like heat pumps. There's a lot of programs now for replacing old furnaces for a heat pump that's energy efficient, but also provides cooling and heating, not just heating. And then at a neighborhood scale, all the things that cities are doing. So things like planting trees, getting rid of impervious surfaces, painting roofs white. Hmm.
So let's actually say you live in an old house that is built to retain heat, like you said. What are some, besides, you know, installing a super expensive HVAC system or something, what are some things you could do to keep your house cool?
I grew up in Mexico, and things like shading, taking a break in the middle of the day and working early morning, working in the evening, planting trees, you know, against a wall where the sun hits a lot during the day. So here I think it's about kind of getting people to know that. And so low cost things are things like fans, creating crosswinds, using lighter paint colors as you're trying to replace your roof, for example.
All right, so last summer was the hottest ever on record, and the World Health Organization says that hotter summer seasons are intensifying because of human-caused climate change. If extreme heat is now to be expected, how should people adapt?
So one thing to do is to actually have a cooling kit available. And in the same way that when you know that a blizzard is coming or a hurricane is coming and you stock up on water, stock up on food, etc., you could also think about heat is coming. So what can you do? You can have cooling packs, you can have drinks with electrolytes, you can make sure that you have access to water, you can make sure you know where the cooling centers are. If you're going to be out and about during the day, that might be identifying even a grocery store or a library or a pop-up shade or a park with a misting station. So kind of at the beginning of the summer, say, okay, I need to make a heat plan for myself so that I can cool down when it's hot. That then would help not just keep you safe, but probably help keep someone else safe that you'll probably run into during the day that may not have thought of heat as a risk.
That's Patricia Fabian. She's an associate professor at Boston University. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the invitation.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Trump says the U.S. attacked three nuclear sites in Iran and that all planes are now out of Iranian airspace. In a post on his social media site, Trump goes on to say a full payload of bombs was dropped on the primary site, Fordo. After more than 3 months in federal immigration custody, Columbia University graduate and activist Mahmoud Khalil has now been released from an ICE detention facility in Louisiana, and he's now in the New York City area, where he says he will continue fighting against the administration's efforts to deport him. And a group of Democratic Texas lawmakers is asking Tesla CEO Elon Musk to delay rolling out his driverless taxis until it's clear the vehicles are safe. Musk plans to test the robo-taxis in Austin tomorrow. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru and its retailers, partnering with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society this June to give blankets and messages of hope to patients facing cancer. Learn more at subaru.com/care. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. We have an important update on our top story. President Trump tonight in a post on Truth Social said that the U.S. has, quote, completed our very successful attack on the three nuclear sites in Iran. He went on to say, quote, we have completed our very successful attack on the three nuclear sites in Iran, including Fordo, Natanz, and Esfahan. All planes are now outside of Iran airspace. A full payload of bombs was dropped on the primary site, Fordo. All planes are safely on their way home. Congratulations to our great American warriors. There is not another military in the world that could have done this. Now is the time for peace. Thank you for your attention to this matter. Again, this was from a post on the president's account on Truth Social, and this comes after Trump on Thursday said that he would make a decision on entering Israel's conflict with Iran within 2 weeks. We've been covering the escalating conflict between Israel and Iran for the past 9 days, and we'll continue to bring you more tonight on the U.S. decision to join the bombardment.
I'm Andrew Limbong. Let's talk about pockets for a second. When I wear a suit, I've got two front pockets and two back pockets on my pants. On my jacket, I've got the two pockets on the side, and there's the breast pocket. There are usually two or three other pockets on the inside, and plus there's usually a pocket on my shirt. But here's the dirty little secret. I'm not carrying that much stuff. Now, my wife, on the other hand, when she finds a dress she likes with just two pockets, it is as if she had dug up a rare and valuable gem from the depths of the earth. Now, why am I babbling on and on about pockets? What does this pocket gender disparity say about us as a society?
So there really is this fascinating and illuminating history about why women don't get to have pockets in their clothes to this day.
That's Elizabeth Evitz Dickinson. She just wrote a book titled Claire McCardell, The Designer Who Set Women Free. It's about the fashion designer who, in the 1930s and 40s, revolutionized the way we think about women's clothing, including pockets.
McCardell always understood the psychology of clothes. She understood how it felt to move through the world, and sometimes you needed a place not just to put your items, like your lipstick and your keys, but also to put your hands. And she understood that it was very important to have a pocket, not just in a pair of pants, but in dresses and skirts, and she fought to include them in all her clothes.
We met with Dickinson at the Maryland Center for History and Culture, which is hosting an exhibit on McCardell's work. Walking in, it feels kind of like a department store, about a dozen or so mannequins lining the walls, all wearing McCardell designs. They have a similar silhouette, fitted at the top with a skirt that flows down from the waist, all different types of colors and textures. I scan the room and we land on a popover dress,
which is basically a wrap dress. And so I think a lot of people think that Diane von Furstenberg pioneered the wrap dress.
But Dickinson says it began with McCardell. This version is white with a thin black patterning. It comes in at the waist with a simple belt you can tie into a knot.
So during World War II, there was this increasingly difficult challenge, which is, what do women wear? This was something that Claire McCardell made in 1942 as a dress for women to easily pop on and off while they were working around the house, going to the factories, and just having to take care of their lives while their spouses were deployed abroad.
The popover dress is one that is elegant yet highly functional. Dickinson says that's by design, literally.
It's really a very simple cotton dress that originally was meant to pop over your existing clothes, almost like an oversized apron. And Claire made this out of a material that was rarely used in women's wear at the time. She made it out of denim. And the original had a big patch pocket because she wanted women to have a place to put a garden trowel or a flashlight when there were blackout drills during the war.
This was a time when women were facing a new world, and they needed functional clothes to help them navigate it, which includes swimwear. We walk up to a glass case. It features a swimsuit that McArdle first designed in 1936. It looks fairly similar to a one-piece bathing suit you might find today, with maybe a bit more coverage in the rear, except it's made out of wool.
I will say, the first time I saw this, I was like, that sounds crazy. That sounds super uncomfortable. I can't conceive of wearing a wool bathing suit. But then I read your book, and in the context of what was going on at swimwear, a wool bathing suit seemed like a pretty good option. So tell us about how this came to be.
It really was. I mean, they were called bathing suits originally for a reason, because women were supposed to wear almost like dresses with skirts. And it was only to go in and sort of wade in and, you know, take a dip. McArdle was a swimmer, and she always wanted to have swimwear that would move with her in the water and actually be something that you could swim in. Not only were there wool bathing suits, but in the 20s, there were wool swim stockings. You were required as a woman to cover your legs on public beaches. And McArdle, she did not believe in that at all. She got in trouble in her 20s for peeling her wool stockings off. And in her career, she designed bathing suits that both fit women's bodies, but also could swim, could dry quickly on the beach. And they were a little bit scandalous at the time because there was no swim skirt. There was fabric between the legs. Mm-hmm. And McArdle always had, again, the experience of the woman in mind. She wanted them to look beautiful, but she also wanted them to be able to swim.
Have you ever tried one of these guys on?
Oh my gosh, I wish, okay, right? But I would get in trouble if I broke through that.
Sure.
They know to lock up the dresses when I'm around.
I see.
McArdle began her professional career after training at the Parsons School of Design in New York and spending some time in Paris. But Dickinson says McArdle's passion for fashion began elsewhere.
So she was born in Frederick, Maryland.
That's right, 1905.
Shout out to Frederick, Maryland. Love the place. Good beer, good hiking. I don't necessarily think of it as like a fashion hotbed. So how did she get interested in design and clothing?
So, you know, in 1905, most women made their own clothes. Ready-to-wear didn't exist really at the mm-hmm. time. There were a handful of things you could buy off the rack or off the shelves. But for the most part, you either sewed your own clothes by memory or by pattern, or the McArdles brought in a dressmaker twice a year to help make clothes. And McArdle was instantly interested, even from a very young age, of the act of making clothes. She was preternaturally drawn to it.
That sounds very fancy, but I take it that's a fairly normal thing for it to have someone come and make your clothes.
Absolutely. It's something that people in the middle class would often have someone help to make clothes, because again, you couldn't shop and get your clothes, you know, from a store at the time.
You can just hop on Amazon.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. There was no Amazon.
Yeah, okay. A big theme of this book is how her clothes look on a hanger versus how they look on a person. And that the fact that they didn't necessarily pop on the hanger meant it was a rough time for her to like get buy-in from gatekeepers, whether it be like her bosses or like buyers at fashion stores. What does that say about how people viewed women's fashion at the time, and how did she sort of overcome that hump?
Her clothes didn't have what her male bosses called hanger appeal, because up until that point, most clothes had been very structured. They had boning in the bodice, or they had ways in which when you put them on a hanger, they had some structure to them. But she was making comfortable clothes.
That choice served McArdle well. Women were snatching up these designs to the point where she was competing with the likes of the big Parisian labels. And her biggest rival at the time, the Apollo Creed to her Rocky Balboa, the designer Christian Dior.
In my research on Claire, I found this amazing article called The Gal Who Defied Dior, and it raised this question of like, what was the defiance? What was the beef? Well, the work that Claire did to free women with these clothes that allowed them to move about the world. In 1947, the war ends, Christian Dior comes on the scene, and he creates something that was called the New Look. It included that classic 50s look that I think we all think of, the broad shoulders, the really tight, cinched waist, and the wide, full skirts. His desire was to, quote, save women from nature, meaning he wanted to structure their body to the clothes. McArdle always wanted to structure the clothes to a woman's life. And she was not happy about Dior trying to cinch women back into 18-inch waists. I mean, Dior's models were literally fainting at some of the fittings from how tight and restrictive the clothes were. And she really did not care for this regression of women being objects versus women being autonomous and independent purveyors of their own lives.
That independent ethos led to a bigger transformation, the creation of the American fashion industry as we know it today.
This beef also encapsulates something, a broader theme in this book, which is America finding its own aesthetic identity, right? Because up until the war, fashion is essentially just like aping off of what they're doing in France, right? And then when the war happens, they'll be like, oh, France is busy doing other stuff. And she's, you know, coming into her own as a designer. Can you talk a little bit about how we finally, if we finally, freed ourselves from the influence of France in our clothing?
Yeah, so you have to remember when McArdle came to New York in the 1920s, there was no American fashion industry as we know it today. There was the garment district, and their job was to copy and steal designs from Paris. Paris was the fashion capital of the world, so much that even American consumers thought there's no such thing as American design. Claire McArdle and her colleagues, mostly women, pioneered the American look, which is what we all wear today. That's casual, comfortable sportswear. And they took Paris on, even before the war, as trying to become the style capital of the world. When Paris shut down because of the Nazi occupation, they had this chance to basically grow the industry and to prove themselves. And McArdle thrived in that moment. But when Paris returned, they wanted to get their title back. And so there was this interesting battle between designers like McArdle and the haute couture designers of Paris. But interestingly, Christian Dior, who thought that McArdle was a genius designer, very quickly started to do ready-to-wear, and you start to see how McArdle's style and her business acumen began to influence the Parisian designers as well.
Okay, so McArdle revolutionizes women's fashion, helps develop the American fashion industry, and even begins to influence other designers. So how come McArdle isn't a household name? Why isn't her jersey hanging in the rafters of the fashion gods along with Coco Chanel, Pierre Cardin, Christian Dior?
There's a couple of reasons for why we've lost Claire McArdle's name. One is she died young. She was 52 when she died. And while haute couture and Paris had a system for carrying on the name of a dead designer, as they did with Dior and Chanel, that really didn't exist in ready-to-wear in America yet. I think the other thing is she was designing clothes for the everyday, and her work is so prevalent as to become invisible. We don't even see it anymore because she invented those everyday items that we continue to wear, ballet flats, mix and match separates, wrap dresses.
And if you ask Dickinson where you can see McArdle's influence today, it's all around us, from women wearing sportswear in their day-to-day to famous people getting dressed up for a red carpet.
I just saw Zendaya wearing a bubble dress, you know, not too long ago, and you can look back and see the exact same bubble dress idea from McArdle. There are so many of our clothes today that you can go back and do. We should do a comparison of then and now, really. So much of her is in our DNA.
Elizabeth Evans Dickinson, thank you so much.
Oh my gosh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to NPR News.
Really has shown to be a good way to prevent tick-borne diseases.
That's because the longer a tick feeds on you, the higher.
You're listening to NPR News. Got any friends who you've been meaning to catch up with, but it never happens? Or are you feeling burnt out on your phone and longing for a more intimate way of keeping in touch? Why not write a letter? Maria Segata from NPR's Life Kit has some tips on how to get started.
There's something special about the relationship you develop with a pen pal. Rachel Syme is a prolific letter writer, and she says these connections are divorced from time and expectation in this really refreshing way.
Like, my friends, I'm in group chats with them, text with them, they're constantly available, I'm constantly available, we're pinging each other all the time. The thing about the people that I write letters to is that, I mean, it's like the slow cooker of friendship, you know? I'll write a letter to them, maybe it'll arrive at their house, you know, given the vagaries of the postal system, in 2 weeks. They'll read it, and I know that it will be read intentionally.
Syme is a writer for The New Yorker and author of the guidebook Syme's Letter Writer. And she says the first step, if you're letter curious, is to write some letters. You can reach out to friends or family or old acquaintances and float the idea.
You know, say, I'm interested in writing more. I'm trying to get more intentional about my writing. I think one way to really sell it to people is say, I'm trying to do less being on my Instagram at 2 a.m. and instead hanging out with my fountain pen and do more sort of purposeful, slow communication with the people that I care about. And I would love you to be the recipient of this attention.
You could also tell them you just got some cool stationery and you want to take it for a spin. Another idea is to send a letter to someone who's made a difference in your life. Your third grade teacher, or that person who showed you kindness in a moment you really needed it. If you want to write to strangers, there are programs you can sign up for. Or you could send some fan mail. Now, a letter can be about anything you want. Some writing prompts from Syme's book. Make your own Mad Libs. Take Polaroids of your life for a week and drop them in an envelope with a message on the back of each one. Or draw a map of a stroll you often take through your neighborhood with pinpoints and descriptions of your favorite memories in each place. Another option available to you, the love letter. You can write those to a lover, obviously, or to a friend.
I think what it has to be about is an act of noticing, an act of sharing certain specific details about the person. You have to think of yourself as a poet a little bit. Like, what am I singing a song of about this person? And sometimes it can be like the smallest things that you notice, you know? It can be like a freckle. It can be a day that you were together and they said something and it's always stuck with you.
Once you've written your letter, embellish the heck out of it. Slap on some stickers or tuck some tiny flat treasures into the envelope, like pre-wrapped tea bags, ticket stubs, ornate wine labels, vintage photographs, iron-on patches. And keep in mind, you might write someone a letter and they might not write you back. Or maybe your pen pal relationship will fizzle out over time. Syme says that's okay.
It's okay. It wasn't meant to be. I think in general, you should practice kind of like radical kindness in this letter writing game, because the truth is it's a hobby. It's something that people should be doing for fun, for connection, for delight. If it's not delighting you, then why do it?
All right, our last tip is to come up with a signature sign-off, one that is uniquely and unmistakably yours. Syme likes to say, see you in the mailbox. I'm still working on mine. But for now, let's go with yours truly, Mariel Segarra, NPR News.
And for more Life Kit, go to npr.org/lifekit. This is NPR News.
Remember that? How about... Takes you back, don't it? In her new book, Hit Girls, Nora Princiati looks at how the artists behind those songs ushered in a new era of pop culture and the music industry. That conversation Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News. He was a boy, she was a girl. Can I make it
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Israel's war against Iran is now in its second week as both sides traded strikes overnight. Iranian state media say at least 430 civilians have been killed since the start of the war. Israel's prime minister's office says at least 24 people were killed, with more than 1,200 injured so far. The heat wave that hit the Plain States yesterday is moving east. Residents are being urged to prepare for triple-digit temperatures in parts of the Midwest, the Ohio Valley, and much of the East Coast in the coming days. Cooling centers are opening in several cities. And Aflac says it found suspicious activity on its network in the U.S. that may impact Social Security numbers and other personal information. The company calls the incident part of a cybercrime campaign against the insurance industry. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. The U.S. has bombed three nuclear sites in Iran, intervening in the conflict between Iran and Israel that started 1 week ago. President Trump announced the news tonight in a post on Truth Social. Joining us now to talk about this latest development is NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram. Hi, Deepa.
Hey there.
All right, so what did the president say?
Yeah, so the president came back from Bedminster, New Jersey, where he was spending yesterday evening. And today he came back this afternoon and he had a scheduled national security meeting. And then later in the evening, he made this announcement about the attack on Iran on his social media website, Truth Social. And in that post, he said the U.S. completed a, quote, very successful attack on three nuclear sites in Iran, including Fordo, which is considered a primary nuclear site. And Trump said all U.S. planes were out of Iranian airspace on their way back to the U.S. And he ended his message basically saying, quote, now is the time for peace.
This is coming after Trump on just Thursday. He said that he would make a decision on entering Israel's conflict with Iran within 2 weeks. So what changed?
Right. So on Thursday, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt held a briefing and she had a statement from the president, which was that there was a substantial chance of negotiations that might happen with Iran in the near future. And because of that, the president was going to make a decision on whether or not to attack Iran in the next 2 weeks. And that statement sort of tamped down on speculation that the U.S. was poised to, you know, imminently strike Iran and its nuclear facilities as this conflict between Israel and Iran intensified. It's worth noting, though, that Trump, you know, initially sought to negotiate this new nuclear deal with Iran. But then in the days after Israel's initial strike, he grew increasingly vocal in his opposition to Iran. And it's this possibility that it could attack U.S. assets in the region. He called for Iran's, quote, unconditional surrender and was posting on social media that the U.S. has complete and total control over the skies of Iran. In a separate post, he was threatening Iranian supreme leader. And he said in, you know, recent days that Iran could be weeks or months away from developing a nuclear weapon. This is kind of interesting and important, though, because what Trump is saying there is at odds with his own intelligence agency's assessments. U.S. intelligence community, including Tulsi Gabbard, who's President Trump's own director of national intelligence, they've all been saying that, you know, Iran suspended its nuclear weapons program in 2003 following the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And Trump has been very vocal saying that they're wrong.
Now, there are obvious fears that this conflict between Iran and Israel can now draw in the U.S. like even more.
Yeah.
Do we have a sense of whether or not the president wants that?
That's a good question. Trump had previously, you know, ruled out the prospect of American troops on the ground, forces on the ground in Iran. He was asked about it yesterday, whether, you know, an attack from the air would be enough. And he said, you know, the last thing you'd want is to have ground forces going in. But, you know, that was kind of before this strike happened. And now that this has happened, it sort of introduces this new level of uncertainty about the conflict and how, you know, how high and how much to what degree the U.S. will continue to be involved. Iran's Supreme leader had, you know, previously decried a potential U.S. strike and said in a post on social media earlier this month that the U.S. would be entering the conflict if that happened 100% to its own detriment. And that post also said the harm that the U.S. will suffer will definitely be irreparable if they enter this conflict militarily. So there's definitely a lot of escalating tensions here. It is worth noting, though, that Trump's own supporters are pretty divided over a possible U.S. role in this conflict. There are conservative figures like, you know, Tucker Carlson and Steve Bannon who have spoken out against it really vocally. In the meantime, there's other representatives like Laura Loomer and Mark Levin in Congress who have supported this. So the president, you know, kind of has a dividing line there. But the thing that we will hear from him later tonight, and he's giving an address about this strike, giving an address to the nation at 10 p.m.
All right. That was NPR's Deepa Shivram. Deepa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Last weekend was a split-screen moment in America. President Trump presided over a parade celebrating the Army's 250th birthday. Meanwhile, millions across the country gathered to protest Trump and the parade as authoritarian. The two events drew vastly different participants. Frank Langfitt, NPR's roving national correspondent, went to both, and he was surprised by some of the things he found, and he's with us to share some of those observations for this week's Reporter's Notebook. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Andrew.
All right, so what are some of the things that strike you as you think back about how you set out to cover both of these events?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things leading into the parade and the protest, you remember there was a fair bit of concern about violence. Here at NPR, we were even having conversations about safety for some of us who were going to go out and cover the day's events. But in the end, Andrew, both sides showed something that I think is kind of in short supply these days in the country, and that's restraint. You know, the people who organized No Kings, those protests against Trump, decided not to rally in D.C. They knew that it could be misconstrued as a protest against the army and could have led to clashes. And the people who attended the parade, from what I saw, they were also restrained. Let me give you an example. I met a guy named Peter Salinger. He's 22. He went to the military parade, but he went there to protest it. And so he was sitting on the lawn near the Washington Monument. He's holding this No Kings sign. And this is what he first told me when we talked.
I don't think it's American to have a military parade. It costs millions of dollars on a president's birthday.
Well, why do you think it's un-American?
I don't think we celebrate our presidents by marching through streets and goose-stepping.
Did people largely leave him alone?
They did. Salinger also was savvy about it, Andrew. He wore this American flag bandana around his head, signaling his own patriotism. And afterwards, I was kind of curious to hear how the rest of the day went, so I called him. And he said there was a guy who hovered nearby, kind of like a guardian angel, looking after him. There were other people who gave him fist bumps. He did get some snide comments. And then Salinger shared this really interesting exchange he had. One guy comes up to him kind of pretty hot and angry, demanding to know who had paid Salinger to come to the protest. And this is how Salinger described it.
I sort of said, you know, I'm just here exercising my rights to free speech. He understood that. He understood when I said that it was my right as an American to be there. I think that maybe appealed to some of his politics. And then he really settled down when I said that I worked in finance. And he said, oh, you know, my son works in finance.
All right. Well, that's kind of funny that they both found some common bond in finance. Did that symbolize anything to you? Was that an example of, I don't want to be like Pollyanna, but like a sort of, you know, commonality between Americans?
I think, and I agree 100%, Andrew, not to be a Pollyanna about this at all. But the fact of the matter is, this is a country where people on either side kind of demonize each other. And then when they actually see each other and they talk, there is more in common than they imagine. And people are not the people, you know, the people on the other side are not necessarily exactly what they expect, which is what you saw here with finance. I mean, this guy clearly did not expect that a protester with a No King sign was a hardcore capitalist in the interest, you know, in the business of making money.
Mm-hmm. So you also went to a No Kings protest in Annapolis, the capital of Maryland. Were there any pro-Trump protesters there?
Not that I saw. You know, I walked through the crowd. I photographed lots of signs, not a single pro-Trump sign. Nearly everybody there was focused on what they see as authoritarianism. In the speeches, though, there wasn't a lot about exactly how to go about doing that.
Yeah. You know, I want to go back to the military parade for a second. I know you as an international correspondent, right? Globetrotting all over the place. How do you think the military parade compares to other such events that you've covered?
What was really interesting is before this, you would remember there was all this criticism that this parade was going to look like something you'd see in China or North Korea. And you heard that from Peter Salinger. He talked about goose stepping. Mm-hmm. I covered one in 1999 in Beijing. There was goose stepping. There was missiles. It was really in your face. And it wasn't just to sort of intimidate foreign powers. It was also a message to the people of China. This was just 10 years after Tiananmen. And it was, don't mess with us. This parade was not really like that at all. You know, the troops were not marching. Some people complained that they were kind of shuffling. And so I think that the parade itself was not what critics feared and not what Salinger expected. At one point, it was frankly a lot more like a pep rally. Like soldiers were driving tanks, they were waving, pumping their fists, revving the engines for the crowd. So I gotta say, that's why it's so good, as you know, as a reporter, to go to these things. Mm-hmm. It really didn't come off the way a lot of people were concerned that it might.
Yeah, so what's your big takeaway from both of these events?
I want to come back to this word, and that's restraint. You know, Salinger came to protest, but he was careful to make his point quietly. Most of the parade goers that I saw, they were really focusing on celebrating the army, not really making it political or cheering on President Trump. And I mean, as far as I saw, only a small percentage were actually wearing any MAGA gear. Now, Salinger was concerned that showing up could be provocative, but in the end, he kind of found the opposite. This is what he thought.
I think being face-to-face with people in some ways felt de-escalatory. When you're just standing next to someone, it's really hard to come up and antagonize them, to get in a fight with them. Like, that's not an easy thing to do. People don't want to do it, and so they revert to wanting to have conversations and to some extent understand your point of view. And that's the real type of like face-to-face interaction that we need to be having.
I mean, obviously this country is bitterly divided. Political violence we're seeing is becoming more common. And it was kind of good to see people like this guy Salinger willing to take risks and spend time with a lot of people with whom he disagrees.
All right, that was NPR's Frank Langfitt, who has reported from what, like 50 countries from all over the world? Is that about right?
Something like that, yes.
Oh my goodness. All right. NPR's Frank Langfitt. Frank, thank you so much.
Happy to do it, Andrew.
Summer is peak travel season with tourists heading to far-flung destinations. But how does all of that tourism shape local communities and ecosystems, both positively and negatively? That's the question at the heart of WHIY's podcast, Peak Travel, which takes listeners to a new destination in each episode. Host Tariro Mzizewa joins us now to talk about it. Hey, Tariro.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
All right. So first, what are some of these hotspot destinations around the world that you've talked about? And what were some of the issues you heard from locals?
Oh my gosh, we have been all over the world talking about all kinds of issues. For example, in Mexico City, we looked at how Airbnb is leading to gentrification. In Barcelona, we looked at how the city feels like it's becoming a bit of a theme park that's essentially built for the convenience of tourists rather than for daily life for locals.
Yeah, and I hear you guys did a whole piece on Antarctica, right? Which, as I understand it, in 2023, more than 100,000 tourists visited the continent, and it's become more accessible than ever. So how does a person actually get to Antarctica?
It's not an easy trip. So typically people fly to the southern tip of Argentina, to Ushuaia, and then they get on a cruise ship. It's like a couple of days long journey, and you go through what's called the Drake Passage, which is a pretty intense journey, huge waves, lots of people getting seasick. It's a huge effort. But everyone we talked to for this episode said that it was totally worth it when they got to the other side of the Drake Passage. There's nothing like it. I think the word a lot of people used to tell me about it was otherworldly.
So I get that, right? And just wanting to explore this new place that not many other people have been to. Scientists who study the continent say that like people have complicated feelings about the tourism.
They do. A lot of scientists feel like people should only be able to go to this really difficult place to get to that has, you know, all this nature that hasn't been exposed to the rest of the world ever, only for research. So that's like a common thing that you hear. Marilyn Raphael is a scientist at UCLA. She studies climate change in the Antarctic region there. And she first visited back in 2011 for part of her research. But one of the most interesting things about this is that Marilyn actually doesn't go back. She, as much as she loved it, as life-altering as the experience of going to Antarctica was for her, she actually does her research from home, looking at satellite data, because she just feels like it's too fragile of a place to keep going back to. And she's a person who really has a reason to go for her work.
We risk introducing non-native species as a problem with managing the waste that comes with tourism. It's inevitable. You can be as careful as you want. Once you set foot on land or in the water around, we bring those problems. We want that Antarctica that we have now to remain as it is. Then we have to exert more control.
Exert more control on tourism. That's an interesting phrase. But in a place like Antarctica, I suspect that's a lot easier said than done, right?
It's definitely easier said than done. A lot of different countries are involved in deciding what happens in Antarctica. Decades ago, they came together and made this thing, essentially an international treaty called the Antarctic Treaty. And through the Antarctic Treaty, governments have had some successes on things like banning commercial mining and passing regulations on waste and marine pollution. But it's really hard for them to actually do too much more because they meet once a year. And on top of that, if they pass a regulation, they also need to take it home and pass it in their domestic legislature, which is very complicated.
That sounds like a bear to deal with, right? Your podcast isn't advocating like stopping tourism altogether, but what have you learned throughout hosting this podcast that you might advise people on how to be conscious travelers?
Oh my gosh. I think so much of the responsibility lies on us as the ones going to other places. So in the case of Antarctica, it starts when you're at the very beginning of your journey, before you've even booked a trip. You look at all of these different tour companies offering different kinds of trips. And if you see that one is really emphasizing luxury and not necessarily like education and not talking about their environmental impact, I think that's a red flag, right? And I think that's something to consider everywhere you're going. If you want to stay at a really fancy hotel, maybe look at what they're doing within their community. What are they doing in terms of who they're hiring? What kind of experiences are they offering? And one of the biggest questions I ask myself, because I spend entirely too much time looking at other people's trips on social media, is like, is that a place I really want to go? Or do I want to go there because I've seen a million photos of it and it looks really cool and everybody's going there?
Yeah, so don't go for the gram.
Exactly.
Yeah. That was Teruro Mzizoa, host of WHYY's podcast Peak Travel. You can listen to it wherever you get your podcasts. Teruro, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we will continue to bring you more on our top story tonight. The U.S. decision to join with Israel and launch military strikes against Iran, according to the president's own account on Truth Social tonight. It is a dramatic escalation in the years-long effort by both nations to prevent Tehran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. Please stay with us.
For NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
X-ray. I've had mine. I'm ready now and raring to go. Little old X-ray told me so. Just took a minute, click, 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 for the picture to show I wasn't sick. Thought I wasn't, but I wanted to know. Honey, baby, I am raring to go. Yes, I'm ready now and raring to go. Cause the little old X-ray told me so. Thank you.
foot.